This is a 980 CKNW podcast.
Welcome to Get Connected. Mike Agarbo here in studio today with Graham Williams. We've got a great show for you. Later on in the program, we'll be talking with Mandy Kovacs from IT World Canada about the Uber self-driving car accident and what it means for autonomous vehicles going forward. We'll also be chatting with the folks at Interact about Cybersecurity Month, making sure that your private information is kept private. And on that note, we'll also be chatting about Facebook with Brian Jackson and that whole, I guess, debacle right now.
It's a thing.
Did you watch Zuckerberg, who's the CEO of Facebook, apologize on TV?
I did. And for a brief moment, he almost seemed like a human being.
Well, we'll be learning more about how that Cambridge Analytica, scandal all broke out and what it means for users as well. In tech news this week, Graham, what are we looking at?
We got a couple of things. There is a discussion going on right now with Canadians about mandatory website blocking. There's a coalition of companies who are maintaining that piracy is so bad that they need to have a mandatory website blocking system in place. These things have been tried around the world and they're not terribly successful. They usually end up equating to censorship. So 100,000 Canadians have actually spoken out on this this plan to block piracy websites. A lot of Canadians believe that it is the responsibility of the police force to handle this. These companies are saying no, they would prefer to do that because obviously there's a vested interest in profit for them. So I would say that honestly, if you have an opinion one way or the other, head over to the CRTC website and you can actually join that 100,000 people.
And will they listen?
Well, the CRTC has actually done a really good job recently of, soliciting consumer feedback and then using that in their rulings. So I'd say, yeah, they will.
You think so, eh?
Yeah, this is your opportunity to be heard, so don't miss out.
YouTube is banning gun videos.
Which is not a surprise considering a lot of the gun violence that we've seen recently.
A lot of dating apps have banned them. Bumble banned photos of their users holding guns.
Yep.
I don't know why you'd have that as your profile picture.
Well, I had my profile taken down because I've just got huge muscles and I said, welcome to the gun show. And no, you're not buying that at all.
No,
got it. Okay.
No. So they're banning gun videos. So they're the latest platform out there to do that.
Yeah. And they're banning these videos. Do you know where the videos are heading?
No.
They're going over to Pornhub.
What?
I'm not joking. You're seeing a lot of the gun-related video content is being posted on Pornhub.
The hell?
Apparently, they have a bit more of an open platform. There's a lot of people out there who have said that YouTube needs a competitor. And right now, the only company that could really rival them for streaming technology, and it's an order of magnitude difference, is actually Pornhub. There are 300 hours of video uploaded to YouTube every minute.
Yeah.
There is 1 hour of video uploaded to Pornhub every minute. So like I said, an order of magnitude, but they're actually, from a scalability standpoint, they're quite close. So they could roll out a G-rated platform where they would offer YouTube some competition.
You think so?
I think they could. I think they should. Good to have competition in the space.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Atari in the news. When's the last time you heard Atari?
Not recently enough. I'm thrilled. They've got a new console.
Yes.
Yeah. And
the Atari box?
Yeah, the Atari VCS.
That was the original one.
That's the name of the new one.
Oh.
Yeah.
What?
That's the official name, the Atari VCS. So they've got a brand new controller. It looks like the Xbox controller. It's got the, you remember on the old joystick, it had the orange button
yes.
in the top left hand. So the controller looks like that. The left stick is orange. And then they have a traditional Atari joystick because their whole thought here is that they're actually going to bring back classic Atari games and have new games on it. There was a system called the Ouya. For a while, which
you
tried
had that.
I had one of these. Yeah. It was $100 and it was basically a glorified Android phone in a box. Played a lot of old emulated games, which it did fairly well. And I mean, it still works, but it didn't quite take off the way that they'd hoped it would. So Atari is about to announce the price on this thing. Apparently, it's going to have some fairly powerful guts. So this could be another contender with Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo.
You're going to buy one.
I'm going to buy one. I don't know how successful it's going to be, but I am a sucker for anything that has Atari on it.
Yeah.
I just recently repaired my 2600 Junior. I put a new power supply together for it.
Sorry, which one?
The 2600 Junior. It was like the 2600, but smaller.
And so did it have games built in?
No. That was, I've actually got a ton of the cartridges and whatnot. I've gone and rescued them from flea markets and so on. So,
oh, really? How much are they when you go?
Usually under about $5. I mean, yeah. I've got 4 or 5 copies of Adventure at this point, and yeah, I dig them. So
very, very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, we get a lot of tech gadgets in because we do the TV show as well. Something that I'm really liking right now, I just thought was amazing. You have an Apple Watch as well.
I do, yes.
There's a company called AliveCore, and they've come out with something called the Cardia Band. Okay. And this is a band that you put on your Apple Watch, and it actually has an EKG built into it.
Oh, cool.
It's like a little thumb pad right on the top of the band, and in conjunction with your Apple Watch, you can actually get some half decent or fairly accurate heart readings. So the Apple Watch has got the heart rate monitor, which basically tracks your heart rate. And in conjunction with the app and this Cardia Band, if it senses anything out of the ordinary, it asks you to take an EKG. So you basically put your thumb on this little thumb pad and you get an EKG that sends the information to the Cardia app.
That's absolutely brilliant.
It's amazing.
I like having more data. That's the one thing that I'm finding. With a quantified life, the more data points that I can get, I'm really into. So that sounds really cool.
So I've learned I'm not long for this earth.
Oh, no.
Well, I'm kidding.
Can I have your Cardia Band when you're done?
Yes, you can. So I tested this with my dad that, you know, he's had some heart issues over the years, and it actually detected atrial fibrillation.
Yikes.
AFib.
Wow.
So I think this has been an issue he's had, but I've asked him to go see the doctor again. And I'm sure the doctor's going to love this. Yes, my son's Apple Watch Band told me that I have AFib.
Why are you here today? Watch Band? Oh.
Yeah, but it's kind of cool, right? Like, it's actually been cleared by the FDA down in the U.S. So, you know, it's a tool, right? Yeah. Obviously, you want to talk to your doctor about this, but it gathers the information, and you can actually have it sent to your doctor if you want. As well, or your caregiver, and you know, send them regular information about how your heart is doing.
That's kind of brilliant. This kind of brings us back to the idea of electronic health records and making sure that they are, one, interoperable, two, secure, and three, that you can actually have control of them. So, you know, Apple Health has been doing some great things. Samsung's got their S Health. Being able to have all of that data in a usable format, I think, is very beneficial for all of us.
Well, that's the dream. Fitbit has also come out with the Fitbit Versa, or will be coming out in the next few weeks, their new smartwatch. I don't know if you've seen them yet.
No, but you said you had a prototype.
Yes, I put them on your desk.
Okay, cool. I will have to take a look.
Obviously,
at them.
In your pile of stuff, you haven't seen them yet.
There are a lot of gadgets there.
Yeah, so it's actually cool. It's got, I've seen some of Fitbit's previous smartwatch incarnations. They're okay, but this one actually looks a lot more stylish. I think it'll be a lot more appealing to a mass audience. It's smaller, lighter. It's going to go for about $250. It's got the heart rate sensor and activity tracker built into it. It's waterproof. And I just think it's the right size, design, and price point.
I'm looking forward to seeing it.
You just use your Apple Watch. Did you ever use a Fitbit?
I did. So I was a huge Fitbit guy. I actually still am a Fitbit guy because I love my Fitbit Aria Scale.
Yeah.
And I had a Flex for a while. I had the one that they recalled because there was the surgical steel issue, right? It was causing contact dermatitis. So they sent me another Flex. They sent me a brand new Flex, which I loved. But since I've kind of rocked the Apple Watch, I'm basically using Fitbit for nutrition tracking and the scale, and then the Apple Watch with Sync Solver syncing up to my Fitbit account that way.
Very cool. We still have a lot more to talk about on today's Get Connected program. Later on in the program, we'll be chatting more about the unfortunate accident with the Uber self-driving car down in Arizona that struck and killed a pedestrian. We'll find out what that means for autonomous vehicles going forward as far as testing. We'll also be chatting about cybersecurity and keeping your financial information safe and secure with the folks at Interact, and a little more about the whole Facebook debacle and what we need to learn from that and what we can do to protect ourselves going forward as far as keeping our information private and out of prying hands. You're listening to Get Connected, brought to you by London Drugs here on the Chorus Radio Network. Back after this. You are back with Get Connected. Mike Agarbo here in studio. I think a lot of us have been reading the news about Facebook over the past week and the whole controversy with Cambridge Analytica, basically improperly using the data of 50 million Facebook users for, I guess, Trump's campaign back in 2016. The U.S., the U.K., governments up in arms about it, and so they should be. On the line right now, we've got our friend from IT World Canada, Brian Jackson, to help us understand how this happened and kind of what it means. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So you've been following this story as well. Did you see this coming?
I have to say that I did see it coming, because back in 2009, I was writing about the Privacy Commissioner of Canada investigating Facebook back then. And in fact, that investigation was about the exact problem that we see here with Cambridge Analytica. You know, what happened is an academic researcher was able to launch this app. People opted in to take some sort of quiz, and that app got access to all of their friends' data. Now, Facebook had to end that policy, you know, allowing researchers or anybody to get data from all of my Facebook friends just if I gave consent, not whether my friend gave consent or not. You know, that was a big problem. And, of course, Facebook wouldn't have done this unless it was basically required to do it by privacy watchdogs around the world. And, you know, the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, of course, is now investigating Facebook again over this incident. So it's just more of the same. And it's exactly what we've seen at every turn with this company.
They've been kind of self-regulating themselves in many ways. I mean, Facebook is just one of these platforms. But do you think that we might see some government intervention happen over the next few years?
Yeah, if by self-regulation you mean they see what they can get away with and then what sort of punishment they might have to endure afterwards, then yeah, I guess they're self-regulating. And certainly this is a time when more government regulators are asking that question about how can we protect our citizens' data, and can these private platforms be trusted in an age where it's so easy to share your data and store it in this huge collective centralized honeypot that is something like Facebook. How do you protect that, and what sort of abuses can happen when the wrong people get their hands on it or decide to do the wrong things with it?
Well, it seems like a lot of wrong people have gotten their hands on this information, and in some cases, you know, I think even swayed elections.
Exactly, and this is exactly the problem with Cambridge Analytica. They've used ads to target exactly the right people with exactly the right message, and whether it was factual information or not, you know, that wasn't of concern to Facebook at the time of the election campaign. So here it is, you know, Cambridge Analytica using data that it basically stole through Facebook and targeting people with fake information on Facebook, all of which the platform takes no accountability for.
I didn't realize Steve Bannon was one of the people behind Cambridge Analytica.
Right. I mean, he was he sort of came to Trump's campaign with that as a tool that he would use to help campaign. It was my understanding of it.
I wonder if Trump and his people will get dragged into this as well further.
You wonder. I mean, there's already so much suspicion about the way that they campaigned and who was involved in funding that, and whether they were even the source of many of the stories that people were reading about the election and campaign. So this just is like more information that adds to that pile of suspicion around the whole story.
So, Brian, what's the lesson for us as members of Facebook?
I think that the lesson here is that people have to start wondering if we're approaching the digital age with the right model for data and data privacy, because this whole model where Google and Facebook and these other technology companies have so much access to our data and are able to monetize it, like, you are the business model here for Facebook. You're not paying because they just want your data, and their whole business model is to sell it to advertisers. And that's exactly what we saw transpire here through a bit of a different backdoor model, right? But as long as it's in the interest of these companies to monetize your data, they're going to try and find a way to do it. So we have to start thinking about ways that we maybe keep control of our data, and maybe it's some sort of decentralized model where I have control of my personal data, and I can give permissions and limits on how other people can access and use that data in a more controlled way.
Are you going to drop out of Facebook?
No, I mean, I use it to stay in touch with family and friends. I think that it's a great way to engage with a lot of people on there. I organize events like canoe trips on it for my friends, so it's a useful tool for me. You know, I think that the better approach, and certainly if you want to delete it and you think you can, that's fine, and you could, but there's also other approaches you could take where you can limit the data you put on Facebook, and you know, you don't have to give it your birthday, and no matter how many times the platform asks me for my mobile phone number, I still haven't provided it, but it's really annoying. It keeps asking about it every other time I log in, I think.
I think I'm stupid because I believe I've given it my phone number, my birth date, and so much information. I think it's kind of a wake-up call, not only to myself, but a lot of the listeners out there, to go into your privacy settings, not only on Facebook, but any of these social platforms, to make sure they have the least amount of information as possible. Because, again, we're seeing they're just not responsible enough to handle our private info properly or responsibly.
Yeah, I mean, they've shown us that so many times now that I would really, you know, the way that I have described it to other friends and family is that don't give Facebook any information that you would walk into like a crowded room and shout across the room to somebody else you know. That's about the extent that you can trust Facebook with your data.
Well, it's interesting. Facebook, they bought WhatsApp, the big messaging platform. Even one of the co-founders now is saying what Facebook has done is wrong and that you should delete Facebook.
Yeah, it's interesting. You wonder what that means for his relationship with his new bosses.
Probably not good. We're talking with we're talking with Brian Jackson from IT World Canada, all about Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and what it means for the future of that platform. Thanks for joining us today, Brian.
Thanks again for having me.
When we come back from the break, March is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. We're going to learn from the folks over at Interact how to protect your personal financial information online. Back after this. You're back with Get Connected. You may or may not know March is Fraud Prevention Month, and as we are living in a more digital society, there's so many ways for us to become victims of fraud. I thought I would help out by getting an expert on the line. We've got Rachel Julica from Client Management over at Interact. Thanks for joining us, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
So how big is fraud when it comes to online payments now?
Well, I think you have to put it in perspective. So when it comes to Interact, we have billions of transactions that flow through the system every year. Now, out of those transactions, we have 99.999% of those transactions that go off without any issue. So it's that really, really small fraction that occurs in fraud. Now, having said that, so let's say for debit card fraud, where someone might skim the information, which is steal the information and duplicate it, the amount of fraud last year that we suffered was $7.9 million in losses. Taken into perspective, though, into account that out of that $7.9 million, only $1.3 million occurred in Canada. Because the criminals, what they're doing is that because we're fully integrated with chip technology, it's nearly impossible to duplicate a card. So what they're doing is they're not stealing the information off the chip, but they're stealing off the magnetic stripe, and then they're going into other countries that are not chip and trying to take out money there. So it's very minute the amount of fraud incidents that we're seeing on the Interact debit network.
So when you talk about, the millions of dollars in fraud, who eats that? Is that you?
That is the financial institution. So all the customers, when it comes to the Interact debit product, there is a zero liability policy that Interact has in place, and that means that any transaction that is fraudulent, that is not caused by the customer, is reimbursed 100%.
So
banks eat that loss.
So you guys are sharing some tips and tricks to avoid becoming a victim of fraud. I think you got a hashtag going. Was it hashtag clicktastrophe?
Yes, yeah. So it's a pretty good hashtag. What it is that it's just giving tips and making really empowering the consumer to be more aware of what to look for. So when it comes to debit card fraud, you know, most people know this. You cover your PIN, you don't share your card. That kind of the expectations is there for Canadians. But when it comes to other types of fraud, such as the one that comes from phishing, for those that don't know, phishing is an email or a text that's masquerading as a legitimate email or text, and with a call to action. Usually, that call to action involves asking for personal information. So I don't know, Mike, if you've ever received one of them. I'm pretty sure. I mean,
I get them every day. I guess I'm a target.
Exactly. And what's really interesting, we did a survey, and we found that almost 25% of responders that are Canadian say that they've clicked on a link that turned out to be phishing and resulted into fraud. So we're seeing more and more of those because I think that criminals kind of moved on now from the debit cards. They know that it's really difficult, if not impossible, to get money out of that type of fraud. So they kind of moved on to something else. And that's where consumer plays a really big role because that's our first line of defense. So yourself, me, the listeners, there's so many things that they can do to prevent themselves from becoming targeted or really becoming a victim of fraud.
Well, let's look at some of the tips that you have. What do you think is the most important?
Well, don't click on a link. That's the first thing. If there's anyone or you receive a text or an email and you're either not familiar who they're coming from, or you don't expect it. So I'll give you an example. Some people receive emails from their financial institution, and they're saying, oh, I think your account might have been compromised. Click on this link and validate your information. Well, banks don't ask for that. So if you're unsure or if there's anything that asks you to confirm information or to input information, the best thing to do is don't click on the link. Don't give them any information. And if it really is your bank, go through the URL and type it in and then go through that method to log in so that you know really it's secure. The other things I would say is that look for any typos. If you get an email and you know the English isn't perfect or the native language or there's spelling mistake, usually that's the first clue. But I find that criminals are getting really, really good. I don't know if they're using a great spell check or translation services, but they're getting better at that. So the other tip I would give is that just to hover your mouse over the link, and if it redirects to a different location than what they say they are, then again, don't click. And really, the best thing is common sense. If you're receiving either an e-transfer or you're receiving an email asking for some information that you're not expecting, so for example, if someone is saying, oh, here, Mike, here's the money I owe you, and this person does not owe you any money, then probably best to just pick up the phone, call them up and say, are you really sending me some money? Or are you really asking me for this? And most likely they'll confirm, and then you can just delete it.
But who doesn't want people owing the money?
I know, but what are the odds that someone is giving you money just because they feel like it? Usually, if it's too good to be true, that's my rule of thumb. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. But if ever you click on a link, or if anyone clicks on the link and they give out some personal information, there's still no reason to panic. The best thing to do in the case of giving out financial information, I would suggest log in to your online banking, again, going through the proper URL and changing that online password. And then the second thing is just call your bank and let them know what you did. So they'll just kind of put an alert on it, and they're going to monitor the account a little bit more closely.
And is there places that people can report these scams?
Yes, absolutely. There's different locations. So there's one, if it is that's related to Interact, then they can just send an email forward, that phishing email, to phishing@interact.ca. And phishing is PH, so that we have a team or we have the resources to actually take down that website so that no one else is receiving those emails. There's also it's the RCMP-led Canadian fraud. I'm sorry, I don't have it with me right now, but you can, if you go and you type in a search for RCMP and fraud, then most likely they're going to redirect you to another link, and you can report it through that method. And it is online reporting.
Rachel, I want to thank you so much for all these the tips you've given our listeners today. And where can people find out more information about them?
They can go on our website, interact.ca. Right on the front page, there's a link for fraud. And I also want to share the information. The Canadian Anti-Fraud Centre has a location online that you can report any fraud that occurred, and they will start an investigation.
Thanks again for joining us today, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Mike.
When you come back from the break, more tech to talk here on Get Connected on the Corus Radio Network. Back after this. You're back with Get Connected. Mike Agarwal here in studio. I think we've all seen the news this week. An unfortunate accident happened down in Arizona. Self-driving car from Uber struck and killed a pedestrian. It's the first fatality from a self-driving car. To help us understand what this means for autonomous vehicles going forward, we've got our tech expert, Mandy Kovacs from IT World Canada. Thanks for joining us, Mandy.
Thank you for having me.
Pretty gruesome. You know, they've released the video footage of this particular accident as well. You know, not only, you know, front facing, showing the vehicle, the Uber car, you know, basically driving full speed into this poor woman, but they also showed the driver. There was an actual driver behind the wheel that's supposed to take over if the car wasn't working properly.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I just watched the footage myself, and I mean, before the footage came out and before the full details came out, that was the one question that was in my mind, was the fact that there was a driver in this vehicle, and somehow that still didn't stop this from happening. It's kind of wild. I know Uber has temporarily suspended its self-driving program, and they're now looking into it and what happened, but we still have no idea what really caused the crash, like what went wrong, why the car didn't stop, why the operator was unaware that this was happening. It's a really bad situation.
Well, I think if you look at the video, the operator was looking down a few times before the actual crash, so not, I guess, fully aware of the surroundings. But, you know, they keep saying that these self-driving cars are safer than human drivers, but from the video footage, it just looks like this car did nothing to stop it. I mean, it was clear that the pedestrian was actually crossing the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's definitely why we're still, you know, 10 to 15 years away from actually having this implemented fully for consumers on the road, is that this technology definitely still needs to be tweaked. It definitely still needs to be developed, really, to make sure that it's at the level of safety and security that we actually need, we need it to be to actually have on roads.
Do you think they've been rushing this?
You know what, that has crossed my mind, and I think it's a possibility. The fact that this was being tested on a public road really kind of says something, too, because in Canada right now, I think there's only been a couple of companies that have been approved to be testing on public roads, but most of it is happening on, you know, kind of separated areas. Like, there's an autonomous car or autonomous vehicle test center in Stratford, Ontario, where a lot of companies have been going and using kind of a sectioned off area. But this whole testing on public roads thing, I think we may have jumped the gun on that for sure.
Well, there's so many companies involved with this now. I know, you know, apparently Apple is working on some type of autonomous software or vehicle. Google was in it with Waymo. Obviously, Uber is as well, because they want to get rid of all their drivers. And all the car manufacturers, too. It's kind of a race to see who can, you know, get these cars out on the road first. But obviously, you know, this accident, we do have a ways to go with the technology. You're predicting 10, 15 years, eh?
Yeah, well, that's what I've heard from the industry. So you mentioned some of the car manufacturers have plans to release autonomous vehicles. And so Ford is actually the first one, or the one that's really released the plan, and they're hoping to be first. And they want to have autonomous vehicles out in 2021, but they're not going to be available for consumer purchase. They're actually hoping to create a vehicle fleet, kind of like an Uber situation, except obviously autonomous vehicles. So, yeah, they're all kind of predicting it won't actually hit consumer markets for another 10, 15, and maybe even 20 to 25 years in Canada, because we have to worry about harsh weather conditions in the winter as well, and that adds a whole new complexity to autonomous technology.
Well, you know, the experts do say that these vehicles are safer because, you know, these cars are completely encapsulated with sensors, like 360 degrees around the vehicles. And overall, you know, if we went to completely self-driving cars, there would be less, you know, traffic fatalities because, you know, let's face it, humans aren't the safest things out there.
No, that's for sure. And I'm a huge proponent for autonomous vehicles. You know, like I would love to be able to drive to work, but, you know, not actually drive myself and, you know, maybe watch a movie or read a book or something in that time that I have because my commute is almost an hour long. So I am definitely looking forward to this, but it requires a whole new, you know, set of regulations and, I mean, even, you know, the legality around them, like who will be liable if something else happens beyond, I mean, what we've seen last week in Arizona. So it opens up a whole new can of worms in many different areas.
I do think we have a ways to go. You know, you keep hearing about these test vehicles, and a lot of times they're in Arizona or Nevada, you know, these places that are basically flat and have, you know, very clean, you know, lines on the road. You know, I think it gets interesting if you have these things driving in cities like New York or London. God, London probably killed dozens of people. Or even San Francisco, you know, with its crazy road system as well. I think there's still a lot of programming that would have to be done for these vehicles to handle those types of situations.
Absolutely. And I think it's also a learning curve for consumers as well, because, I mean, when you're a pedestrian walking down the street, so many people jaywalk, right? So not only do these cars need to be aware of some of the nuances of human behavior, of jaywalking and jumping out in traffic, trying to run across the street, but I think we need to be aware that to some extent we are at fault too. You know, you can't necessarily be doing that. This technology only goes so far as well.
So you're saying, us as humans have to kind of reprogram our thinking for the road as far as being a pedestrian.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you think back to the 18, 1900s when the first car was invented, and that's why there are lanes on the road, because it was to separate the actual vehicles from, you know, the horse-drawn carriages and just the horses and how people used to travel back then. So I think we're kind of seeing a revamp of that. You know, there are no horses on the roads anymore, but you're now going to have normal cars versus autonomous vehicles. And so we're really all going to have to learn to work together and to collaborate until we eventually go fully into the autonomous mode, if that makes sense.
It sure does. We're talking with Maddie Kovacs from IT World Canada. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back from the break, App of the Week time. Stay tuned. You are back with Get Connected. Mike Agarbo here in studio. I've got Graham Williams with me. And it looks like it's that time of the week, Graham. App of the Week. What do you got?
So the App of the Week this week actually comes from the developer of a game called Monument Valley. I think you probably played that. The game where you sort of twist around different geometric structures to make a path for your character to walk through. Very beautiful game. Won a lot of awards. This is a game called Florence, and it's actually quite a bit different because it's an interactive storybook. You play the story of Florence. She's a young woman as she experiences her first love. And the idea here is that she feels like life is an endless routine of work, sleep, and spending too much time on social media. Sounds pretty familiar for some people out there. And one day she meets a cello player named Krish. And
Krish,
and he changes everything about how she sees the world and how she sees herself. So you actually experience this relationship from Florence's viewpoint through mini games, and you're going to play these mini games in everything from flirting to fighting, and as they kind of grow together and possibly as they grow apart. So it draws inspiration from the slice of life graphic novels and webcomics, and it's an intimate and unforgettable story. It's $4 on the App Store. It is for iOS, and it's absolutely beautiful.
You love the games.
I think this one's really neat.
What age would this be good for?
You know, anywhere from, I'd say, like 12 up to, I don't think there's really an upper range on that one.
Okay, so it's like for everyone.
It's for everyone, yeah.
Very cool.
It's a touching story.
Want to encourage listeners out there also to check out our weekly show on Sundays as well, called The App Show. Graham is one of our producers and hosts on that too, and it is a fantastic show. We've been getting a lot of great buzz from it. We talk about all the latest and greatest apps for your smartphones and tablets and smart TVs. So everything from iPhones to Androids, you name it, we'll cover it. And I enjoy it a lot. We also talk about what's streaming as far as the hot shows and movies on streaming services like Netflix, Crave, and Amazon. That is all the time we have left. I want to thank everyone that helps put Get Connected together, and Graham for coming in. We'll see you again next time.
You've been listening to a 980 CKNW podcast. Listen live at cknw.com, the Radio Player Canada app, TuneIn, Amazon Alexa, HD Radio at 101.1 FM HD2, and on the AM dial, 980 CKNW.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.